Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 381. The best education in film is to make one. Stanley Kubrick.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Now, today on the show, we have director Peter Brashai, who made the movie Rapid Eye Movement. Now, one of the reasons why I wanted to bring him on the show is because how he made it. He shot a film in one of the busiest places on the planet, Times Square in New York City. He literally set up right in the middle of Times Square with permission from the film office in New York City. And I wanted him on the show because I had 1,000 questions about how he was able to not only do this, but like, how about all the faces of people in the public that are going to be around? Because there's just tourists everywhere. How he was able to get sound, how he was able to work with his actors, how he did the whole thing. I mean, he was there for a handful of days shooting major parts of his film. And he did not disappoint. Peter came in and talked all about how he did it. Because I thought I had an experience shooting at the Sundance Film Festival with, you know, crowds and crowds of thousands that I couldn't control. But this is a whole other level. I mean, he's in a very confined, small area. Times Square is not a monstrous place if you've been there. It's not like 5 or 6, 7, 8, 9 blocks. You know, where he was shooting was literally in the middle of Times Square. So I wanted him on the show to kind of pick his brain on how he did this, because I know a lot of filmmakers out there want to make low budget or micro budget films. And a lot of the questions we're going to answer in this episode will help you on your journey. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with director Peter Brashai. I'd like to welcome to the show Peter Brashai, man. Thank you for being on the show, brother.
It's a pleasure. I'm very excited to be here. Thank you.
Oh, man. Thanks for coming on. And you reached out and told me about this insane movie that you've done.
Yeah. And we had to hustle to make it. This is what it's all about. So who better to go to than the master of hustle? You
know? I appreciate that. Now, we're going to get into Rapid Eye Movement, which is your movie, because anytime I invite a guest on, it's generally because I want to ask him questions that I want some answers to. And you definitely have – you checked off those boxes without question. Yeah, yeah. So before we get started, man, how did you get into the business?
Okay. Well, I mean, it started when, like a lot of filmmakers, I was 12, 13, in love with movies and made the small movies with whatever technology was available kind of thing, and went to film school in Toronto. Came from Canada originally, and that was okay, you know, but I got out of film school undergrad and tried to make my own films. Didn't do so great at it in the first year or two. And then I said, you know, I need to just get into the business somehow, learn. I still needed to learn. So I wound up going to the UK, actually. I wound up kind of being mentored by a guy over there who's an under the radar script doctor. And he had this little boutique company out there and invited me to join their team. And for a few years, I was on this team doing what we called script clinics. And filmmakers, directors, writers, producers from all over the world would come to this beautiful English estate and hole up for 3 days in this converted barn. And they would come and they would take this, we would take their screenplays and, you know, they had been developing for a long time, having a lot of trouble. They came to us because they had trouble. They couldn't solve their problems. And we would, this little team of four of us would deconstruct the thing and, you know, and rebuild it. And it was an amazing, so while doing this, I was also learning at the same time. You learn by doing, you know, and so that taught me a lot about story structure and I was kind of like the resident brainstormer, you know, I'd kind of like, what about this? And
that sounds amazing. I want to go.
Oh yes, absolutely. I would like to resurrect it here. Cause it's an amazing, you know, because inevitably the first day people would come very reluctantly, you know, they were there because they had in their mind had failed at some level, mm-hmm. right? They just mm-hmm. couldn't get the script past a certain point. They couldn't get the right finance and they couldn't get the right act, whatever. And usually they were sent by whatever company was paying for the script. And they would come really, really against their will, you know, and say, who are you people telling me what to do? Kind of, you know, that was the sort of subtext, right? Mm-hmm. And by the end of the first day, it was kind of like, okay, yeah, you know, maybe, yeah, okay, let's talk kind of thing. Second day, they'd be, all right, this is okay, let's go. That's more. You know? By the end of the third, they didn't want to leave because it just was this incredible thing, you know. So there's the, and I think because we approached it from the perspective of service, you know, we're here mm-hmm. to serve you. We're not here to tell you what to do. We're here to tell us what your vision is and let's make it work. Let's work together and let's serve you. How can we serve you, you know, and mm-hmm. by bringing in. And that was fantastic. So I took what I those few years learned there, and then I said, you know what, I need to get back to what I really set out to do, which is direct and make my own films. And that's when I came to New York, and really committed to making independent films and writing, spending a few years writing and that kind of. I still continued a little bit of the consulting on the side, script consulting, but then I went all in for. Then I made The Dueling Accountant, which was my first. Feature, indie feature.
Which looks fantastic, by the way. I saw the trailer
for it. Yeah,
that
was a lot of fun.
It's basically about an old, you tell it better than I do.
Yeah, it's about a 100-year-old Hungarian multi-billionaire who's on his very last legs, and he's at a board meeting. He's got two companies bidding for pieces of his company and sitting across this huge boardroom table. And he's not interested in their money. He says, when I was 5 years old, in a little town in Hungary, I saw two men pick up swords and fight a duel. And I said, when I saw that, I knew what the meaning of life was. Life is a duel. And he says to the two companies, you can each pick one man to fight a duel.
That's so
and
brilliant.
The winning side can have my entire empire, the whole bloody thing. As he
says. Oh, that's brilliant.
And, yeah. And that's his dying wish, right? And he's married to this beautiful, very young sort of gold
Shocking.
Digger.
Shocking.
Yeah. And when she finds – and then she kind of inadvertently meets – so one company has got a lawyer on their team and he thinks this is an opportunity to make a lot of money and he's a very evil kind of guy and he volunteers immediately. And the hero of our story is this reluctant accountant who has a little bit of stage combat experience. You know, he did some Romeo and Juliet in college, so he knows how to handle a sword. So they force him into it. And he's like, no. And he's this mild-mannered guy, you know. And now he's suddenly drawn into this world of intrigue and adventure. And he meets this beautiful woman when they have this connection. And then we realize this is the wife of the guy, the billionaire. And when she finds out that he's going to give away the entire empire in this nutty sword duel, now she goes into overdrive. To save the money that she wants for herself, right? And of course, you got to have a tribe of gypsies in there who've got a blood feud with the billionaire, and they have their own reasons for wanting to keep the thing.
This sounds fantastic.
It's great. Yeah, it's a blast. It's a blast. It really is.
Now, you shot that movie in New York, correct? That was kind of your first.
Right.
That was your first taste of New York.
First taste of New York. Yeah, micro budget. You know.
Yeah. What was the budget of that film?
That was about 100K.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And now, how is it shooting in New York? Because I've shot a lot here in LA, and it's fun here.
Yeah,
it's right. You know, there's issues.
Yeah.
They're not, yeah. The red carpet is not really laid out for us filmmakers here in LA.
When I did The Dueling Accountant, I knew nothing about filming in New York. You hear the immediate, the kind of conventional thinking is that, well, it must be incredibly expensive. And, you know, because you walk down the street, of course, you see, you know, all the trucks and everything lining up for blocks and blocks, studio films and TV shows. And you think, well, it must be crazy expensive. And then you dig a little deeper and you find it's the exact opposite. So New York City has the Film Commission, which gives the permits for shooting, and it's run out of the mayor's office. And they are literally the most filmmaker-friendly place to shoot. I mean, it's unbelievable. What people don't even realize is that permits in New York City are free.
What?
Okay.
What?
They're free. Yeah. In fact, when I started doing the accounting, it was literally free, not a penny. Now it's $300 for the total for everything. It's just an administration fee. Mm-hmm. So you're not going to pay now. Yeah, exactly. For everything. Okay. And not only that, like when we did The Dueling Accountant, we wanted to shoot in the West Village and the, you know, old cobblestone street. And there's a scene where this band of gypsies kidnap the accountant, you know, and they literally pull up in this 1962 Cadillac and they grab him, they throw him in the car and they race off down and burn rubber and all this kind of stuff. Well, guess what? The city closed the entire block down for us. And they put police at one end, at each end of the block.
Which you have to pay for, of course.
No, nothing.
Oh, come
nothing.
On.
I'm not even kidding. I know. It blew my mind then. It still blows my mind. Okay?
You mean they give you police?
They give you police. They'll shut it down. They keep the thing organized. Unbelievable. Okay?
I know people here in LA are listening to this.
I know. Like, I mean, like in LA, you've got to pay the permits to shoot in someone's house, right? Inside someone's house. I mean, it's like –
you literally here in LA, if I want to shoot in my own house,
yeah.
You technically need to get a permit. I mean, yeah. And I've actually heard of people who have been ticketed for shooting inside their own house because a neighbor called.
Yeah, yeah.
And exactly. I'm like
– yeah.
And they weren't going crazy. There wasn't like 1,000 things going on. It was just like –
I know, yeah.
Really? And I had to go to court and it's a thing and
– yeah.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
I think a lot of it is just – is legacy and culture. So I mean I think, you know, L.A. is historically a studio town, right?
It's where it starts. Yeah.
It's where it starts and it still is to a large extent even though it's a globalized industry now. But I mean it's that mentality is it's a studio, you know, huge conglomerate town kind of thing. New York City has always been the rebel, right? It's right. but somehow the city itself has the powers that be have embraced this and then of course when we did Rap on a Movie, that's a whole other layer too, which we'll get to. But I mean, so absolutely. And then so just to go back to your original question, so after I did that, then that was kind of my calling card film, and through that I wound up getting the next film, which is called Colors of, which is originally called A Million Colors, also called Colors of Heaven here, shot in South Africa. And that was a big, I kind of jumped from the micro budget thing to an epic film in South Africa, you know, hired to do that. And I had 800 extras. It was a period piece. It was, you know, 65 location. I mean, it was a huge thing and it was an important film for South Africa and it was a Canadian South African co-production. And that was an incredible experience. I mean, because my whole life, you know, that's what I dreamed of doing, international epic filmmaking. And I got to do it, you know, so that's a whole other story.
But how do you go from $100,000 micro budget comedy basically to an epic international production in South Africa? Because I saw the trailer for both.
Yeah.
And they don't connect. I mean, there's definitely talent there, but they're definitely not something that you would translate into an epic, you know. I was just curious on how that happened because I'm sure everybody else would be curious as well.
Yeah, it's a long story, but I mean, essentially, going back to my England experience as a script doctor, right? Mm-hmm. I was this young kid doing this, right? And one of the people that came through was this producer from South Africa. And he used to be in Hollywood back in the 70s. All right. He was the vice president of MGM. You know, he worked with, David Lean was my hero and Kubrick. I mean, it was just incredible. So, and for years he had been back in South Africa and had been out of the film business and was getting back in, and he was going to, and he had this, it was a different script at the time that I was helping them with. And I was like the bad guy, right? Cause I was tearing apart the work they had been doing for 6 years, whatever. But then I kind of rebuilt it for them. And what started off as this very contentious relationship in England or in this script setting suddenly became, wow, this kid has actually maybe gave us some hope to make this movie kind of thing. So
that's how it
is. And the last day, you know, after a fight after fight after fight, he was driving. I said, "You want to drive me to the airport?" I said, "Sure." And he starts telling me the story about this kid in South Africa at the time, was a kid in the 70s, who was the most famous movie star of the time, a black kid from the townships who was embraced by the entire country, black and white, because of this incredible movie that had come out at the time. It was about the friendship between everybody. And he said, but he has what people don't know is his true life story, which is even more incredible. And he says, "One day I'm going to tell that story and I want you to do it." I said, "Great."
and I know everyone listening has had those conversations with people throughout, like, "Oh yeah, yeah. One day I want you to make this movie about this Iron Man guy. I like you, kid.
Well, I had proven myself to him on the script side. Right.
Right. Right.
But I had to make the dueling account. I had to show, a couple of years went by until the real opportunity, you know, until he was ready to do it. And that became a long process, the financing and the international co-production. But I had made this movie. And what was most important from the producer's perspective on The Dueling Accountant was not that it cost $100,000, but that I took $100,000 and made it look like $1 million. Mm-hmm. And that was the key, right? So he knew what I could do from a story structure and script perspective, but Every it doesn't matter what budget level you work at, everybody wants your budget to be stretched to the as far as they can, and I think that was the goal here. It was a great opportunity, and it was an incredible. I could write a whole book on making that movie because it was very complicated on so many levels, but it was an incredible experience. Yeah,
and I think that's a lesson for people listening is if you can always make a dollar look like $100.
Right.
Then you're always going to have work. And I think Robert Rodriguez coined that phrase when he was first coming up. He's like, "Look, I'll know I'll always work because I can make things look amazing. So I'll always have a job." And if you're able to do that, you can bring high production value at low cost.
Yeah.
Someone's going to hire you.
Yeah. I think, you know, filmmakers, we've all got to remember this, which is that we think we need tons of money to get things to put in the movie, right? But at the end of the day, your frame is this big, right?
Yep.
It's got edges on it, and it's only what goes inside those edges that are going to determine what it looks like. And you could have a lot of resources or very few resources. You're always going to have things like composition and color and location, you know. And if you play those cards right, that's how you kind of take it to the next level, right? So, that was an amazing experience. But then after, you know. It was a 5-year ordeal to make that movie in South Africa, and we did all the post production in Canada, and I had to fight unbelievable battles with when you're a hired gun, you gotta fight, you know.
Even worse when you're a hired gun.
When you're a filmmaker, you're always gonna have headaches, right? If it's your own film that you're in charge of, then you've got the headache of making it successful and making your money back and all that kind of stuff. When you're a hired gun, you've got the headache of having to fight for your vision and getting everyone else's fingers off the thing, because we had some epic battles on that. So, and that's a fascinating story, but that's for another time.
Would you agree though that every single project is just opportunities for you to gain shrapnel and to gain scarring and thickening of that? It's kind of like almost forging yourself with the fires of the projects that you're on, and it's every single project, it's every single situation in this business. You are chiseled just a little bit tighter, just a little bit to the point where, when you're someone like Spielberg, who's been in God knows how many, you know, battles in his life and so many projects, and also at levels that you and I can't even comprehend.
Right, right.
You know, when they walk on set, it's like this old battle-hardened generals. Yeah, you know,
what I've discovered, I actually discovered this going back to when I was this young script consultant kind of guy. You know, it's we had filmmakers come and writers, screenwriters from all over the world, right? Including some from Hollywood, some like A-list writer. And I actually found that the bigger they were, the more humble they were. It was something about, you know, they were had been in the battles for a long time and they're still trying to make it like anybody else, even though they've got the Oscar nominations and they've got the mm-hmm. big, and it's like, they want to keep getting better, you know, not everybody, but I mean, overall I found, and that was really amazing to me. And I remember not too long ago, I think it was at Ang Lee, he had an interview and he said, you know, I'm still learning and I'm still learning how to, and those battle scars you're talking about, that's what's it about. You got to keep learning and keep getting better, because every honest filmmaker or artist in general looks at their work and it's like, nah, I could do it better. You know?
Well, as they say, I forgot who said this. I forgot. It's a famous artist, but he's like, art is never finished. It's abandoned.
Yeah.
And it's very, very true. Let's talk about your movie Rapid Eye Movement, because that's the reason why I invited you on the show. Now, please tell the audience what the premise of this is. And then we're going to get into how you godforsaken made this thing.
So Rapid Eye Movement is a psychological thriller about a New York radio DJ, Rick Wider, whose job is on the line, his ratings are going down, and he needs to pull off a publicity stunt to keep himself in the game. And he comes up with an idea to do a sleep deprivation marathon, a wake-a-thon, in a booth in the middle of Times Square, ostensibly to raise money for charity, you know. But he's really out to save his job. And he just very callously picks a disease to raise money for, you know, not realizing that this unleashes the interest of a killer who has a vested interest in finding a cure for this disease. And he tells him, if you don't raise $5 million in this wake-a-thon before you fall asleep and break the record, I will kill you. And so now he has the incentive you know, to stay awake as long as he can and to break the record. The only way he can make anywhere near that amount of money is to go all the way, to go the distance. And so the movie is really this, and the record for staying awake, by the way, is 11 days, right? Mm-hmm. 264 hours. So the movie is this kind of odyssey, psychological, physical, mental, and emotional odyssey through this 11-day journey to stay awake against all the odds. If he doesn't do it successfully, he's going to die. At the beginning of the film, I like to say that the stakes are for him to save his job, right? By the end of the first act, he gets this life-threatening thing from this killer, and now the stakes are raised. He has to save his life. As we enter the third act, he realizes that it's about saving his soul. Stakes are even higher, and because what he goes through in this journey is a complete breakdown physically, emotionally, mentally, spiritually. In other words, the complete human experience is just like disintegrating as he's trying to stay awake and has to summon whatever it takes to do this. And it's just this wild ride, you know, and the fact that it's, I like to say it's a small movie and a big movie at the same time, because on the one hand, it's a contained thriller, you know, he's in this broadcast booth, but it's in the middle of Times Square, and we call it the crossroads of the world. And he's surrounded by thousands of peering eyes, you know, into what he's doing. And it's both intimate and epic at the same time. And that's what I loved about it, you know?
So, okay. So there's a lot to unravel here.
Yes.
First and foremost, we understand now that the New York Film Commission, they walk on water and they love filmmakers and they just throw whatever you need at them. But to shoot for so many days on Times Square, which is arguably the biggest area in New York and the busiest area of New York on a daily basis, day in, day out basis, how the hell did that happen? How did you convince them to go, I need to shoot in Times Square for how many days?
So the total shooting schedule was 23 days.
You didn't shoot 23 days in Times Square, did you?
No, we shot 12 days in Times Square. Yeah. Okay. So we had a few other,
Still plenty.
Yeah. And 12 days and nights, right? And so come back to what I said before. Yes, the permits and everything, you can shoot anywhere in New York pretty much for free and easily, right? With Times Square, there's one proviso there, okay? If you want to go into Times Square or like anywhere in New York with a camera and you're handheld and you want to run around and do, no problem. You can do that, right? In our case, it was different because we had a set. And we had to build a set and we wanted the set to exist there, okay? Mm-hmm. And Times Square is mostly now pedestrian walkways, right? You've got Broadway and 7th Avenue that cut through it. But the rest of it is all this. So there's masses of space where it's pedestrian. And so my idea was initially, you know, we'll put down our booth there and shoot for whatever amount of time we needed. And then we went and met with the commission, the film commission to save us. Right? And the moment we said that, he goes, the moment you put a set down, you put any structure down, okay, then you're not talking about a regular permit. You're talking about $40,000 a day to do that.
Right. Right.
Right. And so he said, no. Now, let me backtrack a little bit. There's a lot of technical challenges here, right? So the initial, there's three approaches to doing this movie, right? Which is one is to, and this is kind of the original idea, was we do a little bit of shooting in Times Square, just some exterior stuff, get the wide shots, the, mm-hmm. you know, kind of thing. And then we go into a studio and we green screen everything.
Sure.
Okay. Of course, that has all of its pitfalls, right? And it never quite looks the way you want it to look. And there's a lot of issues in what you can and can't do with reflections and smoke. I mean, atmosphere, anything like that. So then I began to research using rear projection as an option, mm-hmm. where we'd go into a studio and we would project Times Square behind the booth, the glass. And again, do a little bit of shooting in Times Square. And I did tons of research on how to make that work and studied. The guy really pioneered that the best was Kubrick, 2001, all that stuff.
Kubrick and Cameron,
using rear projection techniques. And it's really interesting. But again, your rear projection at that scale works when the backgrounds are not very clear and that kind of thing. When you're dealing with very intricate detail like Times Square, which you want to show all of that, the projection becomes a real nightmare. It's hard just to move the parallax. When you move the camera, it looks really weird. And so anyways, so then we go to this meeting. Okay, we're going to this meeting with the film commission to tell them what we're doing. You always want to go there and just tell them, hey, here's what we're doing. This is the kind of permits we're looking for. And right away, he just shuts down. You put a set down, you got to get special permission from the Times Square Alliance, which is this company that basically administers all of Times Square, everything. And any event that takes place there, any structure, whatever, it's they're the ones that are in control of it. The film commission gives the permit, but Times Square Alliance runs the show, right? And they're the ones that say yes or no to everything. And if you put a structure down, big, big money. Then the guy goes, he kind of leans forward and he goes, now listen, he goes, you saw Vanilla Sky, right? I go, yeah. You remember Vanilla Sky, the Tom Cruise movie?
Of course, yeah. They shut down Times Square.
Well, so there's two or three shots in that, right? So the famous one where they shut down Times Square for half an hour, where he takes that Ferrari, and the whole thing is they did it on a Sunday morning, I think. From they set up at 3 a.m. and they had then it's the moment the sun came up, they shot for like 20 minutes or something like that, and that was it. On a Sunday when there's almost no traffic anyways. But if you remember, if you go to the end of that scene, then it cuts to Tom Cruise is kind of got his arms out and he's standing up and the camera does a 360 around mm-hmm. him and he starts to scream, right? He goes, you know what? Tom Cruise was standing on the back of a flatbed truck and they had the camera really low. And he said, if you just tilted the camera down, you'd see millions of people in Times Square. He did that all out right there. So he said, if you put your booth on the back of a flatbed truck and drive it in, okay, no. Not on the pedestrian area, but on the street, then we would technically just need to give you a parking permit. And I'm like, what?
You've got to be kidding me.
He told me. It was his idea. He told me this.
Wow. Like,
So now, okay, but now he's thinking, when we're talking about this, in his mind, it's like we're going to do that for one day. You know, we're gonna have the booth, drive for one day, do our and even so, you know, get your wide shots and da da da, and then you go into the studio, do your green screen, and then you got it. Okay, we leave that meeting, right? And I said, what? Let's do the whole movie like that.
Of course, like a psychotic filmmaker would.
Right. Why? What do you mean one day? We just drive in and just do the thing? What are you talking about? Let's do it. Okay. So the next step now is we have to go to the Times Square Alliance because they're the ones that get the permission. Okay. So we set up a meeting and the guy was amazing. Right. He's just like amazing. And so we sit there. He's got this like mission control kind of thing of Times Square. He's got monitors everywhere. You can see like every nook and cranny of Times Square, right?
That's it's just amazing.
Like, yeah, cameras everywhere. It's like this huge NASA operation. It's amazing. We're sitting there, my producing partner, and it's like we tell him what we're going to do, what we want to do. We're going to shoot the whole movie, this thing in Times Square with this booth. And he just starts laughing. It's like, what are you talking about?
You can't do that.
I just thought it was ridiculous.
We wouldn't give Tom Cruise that. Why wouldn't
we give it to you? No, exactly. Tom Cruise had 20 minutes, right? 20 minutes.
Right.
All right. And we need 2 weeks to do that, right? With a set. Tom Cruise didn't even have a set, right? They just stood there with a camera running around. Okay. So then we start methodically explaining. And by this time, we went in there armed with some of the technical aspects of it, right? And the pitch to them was that the set is going to be on the back of a truck, flatbed truck. The set itself is going to be have all the lighting is going to be built into the set. Okay, it's going to be self-contained practical lighting. The entire movie is going to be handheld. In other words, the whole operation is going to be on the back of this flatbed truck, and we literally need to drive in and drive out.
Every
with
day.
A parking permit every day or every night, and we're not going to bother anybody, and no one's even going to care. It's like the more we talk about it, he is intrigued, right? He's like, what? He's just, wait a second, and he kind of became like,
I want to see this happen.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, is this really? What this sounds? He thought it was cool. It was the cool factor, right? And the audacity factor. You know, when you go in there with some audacity, and that's very New York also. In fact, he even told me, he said, look, I don't care if you're Warner Brothers or independent film, we treat everybody the same here. Everybody gets the same shot, right? It's just about making it work. Okay, so then he said, all right. He didn't say yes right away, but he said, he's negotiating a little bit, right? And he said, now what we can't do, I can't give you 2 weeks in a straight shot, right? He says, but could you do 2 days at a time, 3 days at a time here and there kind of thing? And I said, yeah, absolutely. Because we had some other locations like to set up the film, and there's the radio station at the beginning and there's like a chase at the end.
Sure.
And I said, absolutely, we could do that. He said, all right, let's reconvene. I'm going to look at my schedule. You look at your dates, you figure out what can work for you and what can't work for you. And let's compare notes in a couple of weeks. Right. So we did, we got back in the same office and he pulls out his calendar. We pull out our calendar and we just made it work the dates. Right. And, it just happened. I mean, it literally just happened.
Yeah. Wow.
And now the funny thing is the word that he used was unprecedented, right? So he said, he told us this. He said his real concern was not that the actual shoot would be disruptive or whatever. He was worried that we'd be setting a precedent that other filmmakers would want to take advantage.
You know, I was about to say, I'm already writing a movie in my head.
Yeah, exactly. right, exactly. And I'll see that movie. Yeah, definitely.
Exactly.
And I love, because now I just love Times Square. I mean, Times Square, I feel like it's part of my blood. You know, I just love it so much. And the funny thing is, not only did they give us the permission. Oh, by the way. So then he said, we still need to get the permits from the film office. Right. So he said, okay, let me talk to him. He said, this is the Times Square landscape. Let me talk to him. And, he told me later, he had called the guy and he said, okay, yeah, these guys, you know, their plan actually makes a lot of sense. They want to get the dude in the truck and they got it. And they're going to shoot the whole film there. And the guy goes, what do you mean the whole thing? I said they could shoot for a day. He goes, well, no, but it's cool. They can do the whole thing on a truck. And it's like, and he said, well, he says, are you okay with it? He goes, yeah, we're okay with it. He says, okay, I'm okay with it. All right, I'll give them the permits. All right, that's fine. So they just gave us the permits, right? And again, and they moved a few. So what they really did was they actually shut down part of a traffic lane for us. They literally just shut it down. Like again, this shutting down, you know, and we had that whole section.
Did they have police there the entire time?
Well, there's police anyways.
That's true. Yeah, it's Times Square.
It's Times Square. There's security everywhere. But when we were setting up initially, they came in and they were just looking at it and
they're like,
they
were what are you guys
supportive.
Doing?
Yeah, yeah. It was, no, they were supportive. They were amazingly supportive, you know. I'll tell you what was the weirdest thing. Here, now, this is one of those fluky things, okay? Of course, now, to pull off – so to get the location, to get the set, and also the set – we should talk about the set because that was also a very particular thing that we needed for sound. But the whole thing – was predicated on getting this flatbed, this 12 or 16 foot flatbed truck and building the thing on there, right? Kind of thing. So we had reserved a flatbed truck way in advance of our shoot, right? And we put the money, we had the whole thing lined up for one of the big rental companies. 2 days before the shoot.
Of course.
There's no truck.
Of course. Like, well, of course.
All right, give us another one. All right, so they don't have any. So we go to the next rental company. They don't have any. They go to that. We went to every single rental company and nothing. They start looking outside of New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore.
So what happened?
We start doing the whole Eastern Seaboard. There was not a single flatbed truck anywhere. It was like, what is this, like some kind of cosmic joke that's being played? That's kind of thing. And the whole movie was going to literally fall apart because we couldn't get a stupid truck.
Right.
I said, that doesn't make it. How can you get all of Times Square, but you can't get a truck? You know, it's like Murphy's Law to the nth degree kind of thing. Right. But one of my partners he just was running around every garage in New York City. He spent those 2 days, and at the last minute, he found one. You know, but it was too long. It was longer than it was like an 18 or 20 foot or something like that instead of a, because there was a kind of a space between sort of two walkways where we can park the thing right in the, it was literally right in the middle. By the way, the guy in the Times Square Lions guy said, you know, where would you want to set the thing up? And I said, well, you tell us, you know, what's the best for you. No. Just tell me if you could shoot anywhere into, where would you be? I said, we'd be right on this corner, you know, right here, you know, Broadway and 44th, you know, right in front of ABC Studios where they do Good Morning America. Mm-hmm. Cause that gives you the entire 360 of Times Square, you know, and that's what we got. We got that. But there was a kind of a narrow space between the walkways. We probably thought we couldn't block those. And so we get this one truck, you know, and it was too long. So we're building the thing on the truck, and we were in Brooklyn where we had our production office. And we sent one of our guys down to Times Square with the measuring tape. I said, go and measure that spot that we have, because if it's just, and he went down, we're just waiting for the phone call. Okay. We're waiting for the call. And we were within 1 inch of the thing.
Oh,
fit there. I get strangely calm in those moments when you have no control over everything. That's all you do is pray. All you do is pray. That's it. That's all you can do.
So I have a couple questions. So now we figured out how you were able to do this impossible feat, which I'm curious to see how many more movies are going to try to do this after you.
Yeah.
But that's not your problem at this point. But because you've already set the you're already unprecedented. So,
right.
So I always had this question for filmmakers, and since your film has been sold and it's being sold around the world, how do you deal with logos? How do you deal with pedestrians and people's faces and things like that in a public environment? And I think a lot of people would like to know that. I have my theories because I shot an entire movie at the Sundance Film Festival.
Without
anybody at the Sundance Film Festival knowing that I was doing it.
Yeah.
So I'm curious what you think.
Big question. We had to get that sorted out ahead of time. We didn't want to make the movie and find out that we can't show it, you know, so we had to look into that. So the first thing is the logos. So of course, Times Square is riddled with logos everywhere.
Yeah.
And the basic rule of thumb is that if you show any kind of branding or logo or anything like that, in the way that it was intended to be shown or used, mm-hmm. then you're within safe grounds. Okay. So in other words, if we're shooting at Times Square and there's Coca-Cola in the background on the big, huge thing in Times Square, and we just show it as it is, it's advertising Coke. Mm-hmm. It's therefore advertising Coke in our movie, in a sense, right? And so it's being used in the intended form that it was designed for.
So it's kind of like,
if you start to mess around with it, then you can maybe get into trouble, you know?
Right.
There's a second factor, though.
Real quickly. So what I always used to do, and I always told people as well, is like, if you drink a bottle of Coke, like there's a bottle of Coke in a scene with a bunch of actors in a house, and you drink that Coke and you just talk and do everything, you should be okay. Now, if there's a murder, you hit somebody over the head with that bottle of Coke, that's a problem. Even if there's something really awkward going on in the scene, you might have a problem, because you don't want – a Coke might not want to be involved with a threesome that's going on.
Right. Because the Coke bottle was not intended to be a weapon. It was intended to be –
intended to be inside of a threesome. So there is – but if you use it in the way it's intended, you're good.
Yeah. Also, there's a secondary factor I read about, which was that in television advertising, you can run into trouble if you show Coke in your film and Pepsi is sponsoring the show.
Yes.
It's a conflict, and they don't want to have that. So then you can limit. Right? That's becoming, I think, less and less of an issue the way advertising works. But that's something to consider.
Yeah, that's now. Yeah, and then how about people and faces?
There are scenes in the film where we actually wanted. You would typically hire an actor or an extra, depending on how big the thing was. And we actually wanted to use people more than just sort of way off in the background kind of thing. And in those cases, we had our PA standing by with release forms. And if they were going to be featured sort of prominently doing something in the film, as opposed to just standing, observing, then we would get them to sign a release.
Just kind of to cover your butt. But generally speaking, if there's someone walking in the background of a scene or in front of a camera and it's kind of like walking behind a character, you're okay.
Totally okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
If they say a word, absolutely you need a release.
Yeah. And there's a scene in the film where he has a big, there's a impromptu dance party, you know, in front of the thing just to keep the energy. And it's this big salsa thing and it's a blast. We just roll people in for that. And so they're actually performing in a way, you know, but again, you get them to sign release.
It's so fascinating that you're doing this in Times Square.
It's pretty
fascinating. Now, what was the budget of your film?
So the budget all in was about $250K, which is, I would say the production was about $227 is the actual number.
Sure.
And then post-production, very tight, but I did a lot of the post-production.
I was going to say $25,000 is pretty cheap to do everything.
I did a lot of it myself. And a small team, but we have 30 CGI shots in the film. We have, an amazing sound. We actually mixed it at one of the top sound, stages here in the city. We got an incredible deal there. And again, you just have to hustle to get the best deals you can get, kind of thing. But a lot of it is just takes, you know, blood, sweat, and tears to do it. Yeah.
Now, what are some of the struggles that you had to deal with in an uncontrollable environment? Because you had somewhat control of your specific area, but you really, it is madness. It's you're literally in the center of a hurricane. You're in the eye of a storm. What are some of those struggles that you have to deal with as a director, just trying to get your shots? I mean, you are up on a flatbed, but that I didn't know that part before I thought of the question. But it's still a thing.
Yeah. Well, the schedule is always the toughest, right? Because I think you're having to. There's a lot of film in this film, right? There's a lot of it's a lot of complex stuff happening. It's a very layered, detailed script, a lot of action, plot twist and everything. And it's a very tight shooting schedule, and you've got to stay on schedule. And that's all, time is always your number one enemy. And so you've got to come in there being really, really highly organized. You've got to have a cohesive team, you know? So that's always a struggle, but it worked out pretty well here. I would say, you know, I didn't, it was actually just really, it was a lot of fun, to be honest with you. I mean, the Times Square, the chaos is actually good for the film, because that's real.
It's part of the whole thing.
Exactly. That's the story. And so, you have to think about weather, because, you know, we didn't have any cover weather-covered opportunities, really. So it was a bit of a gamble. However, I mitigated that by looking at the script and how we broke down the script in terms of the schedule, so that I made sure that every single scene in the film was shot within one actual day, one half day, right? Where the weather would be consistent within that half day. You don't want to shoot part of a scene one day and another part of the scene a different day, and therefore have completely radical weather. So in other words, whatever the weather was for that particular scene, it doesn't matter if it was good weather, bad weather, raining, not raining, it would be contained within the actual scene and it would be consistent. And in fact, it only rained on one day, and it was the perfect day because it was day 7 of the Wake-a-thon, where he's really goes into this very deep, depressive kind of soul searching speech on the air. And we just had the raindrops on the glass, and it was perfect, you know. So that was one bit of serendipity.
Now, do you? I mean, and I again on a much smaller scale. Well, I mean, on a different scale, I did this with the Sundance Film Festival, and there was, you know, tens of thousands of people, and you kind of rolling around with it. The difference, this is what I always say, and I'd love to hear what you say, is that when you're in an environment like that, you're in an uncontrollable environment, which is unlike normal filmmaking. In filmmaking, as a director, you need to control everything. You need to control lights, actors, environment, everything completely. But when you're in an environment that you can't control, you will lose your mind if you feel that you need to control everything.
Right.
You won't survive.
Right.
So what I did is I just kind of flowed with something that just showed up. It now became part of the story, or it came part of the scene. And if it didn't work within the narrative I was trying to tell, I would adjust it or maybe pivot here or there because we were on time and we didn't have the time to do things and we were flowing so hard. Would you agree that's the kind of the way you went around it as well?
Yeah. And I think what you're talking about is staying cool. You know, you got to stay cool. That's the key thing, because filmmaking is problem solving, right? And it's every problem that shows up is an opportunity to come up with a creative way to solve it. And oftentimes it's a better thing that you wind up with. But you, in your mind, you've got to stay calm and you got to look at it as this is the job, right? This is not an aberration to the job. This is the job. When you're doing this kind of filmmaking, that's what you sign up for, right? And so you embrace it and you got to stay cool. And of course, if you got a crew and cast, they're looking to you as the director to maintain that tone where we can solve this and we can make it work. So yeah, I think it was great. I mean, it's really, you know, the hardest job was not mine. The hardest job is our actor, our lead actor, Francois Arnault. Yeah. You know? So because he has to go nuts and lose his mind and expose himself emotionally in the middle of Times Square. Like, you know, it's this huge thing, you know? And so it takes a lot of courage, and he's an amazing actor. So he said from the very beginning, you know, he was scared. This is a scary proposition to do.
Of course.
And that this being scared of it is also the attraction, because a great actor wants to live on the edge of his craft and go for it. And he went for it all the way, kind of thing, you know. So
now how did you direct performance in an environment like that? Like, as a director, how do you, you know, again, in my scenario, it was really complex. You have to trust your actors implicitly in an environment like that, because you don't have the opportunity to pull a Kubrick or a Fincher where you're taking 50 or 60 takes of the same thing and kind of like working out the nuances. That's not what this film, at least from what I'm seeing, was like. How did you do it?
Actually, we didn't do 50 takes, but we did, you know, like those guys, but we did, you know, on average, I would say 4 to 6 takes,
Of course.
It was reasonable.
It's reasonable.
Now, well, here, the first thing is the space itself. Okay. So the set is a diamond shape, and it's about the equivalent of 7 or 8 square feet. Okay. Now it's very tight. Now, initially my thinking was that, you'd have the actors in there with the camera operator and that's it. And then I would be outside on a monitor of some type, and with whatever else crews out there. Okay. As soon as we showed up there, I said, that's not going to work. The day one, I said, I've got to be in there with them. It's got to be exactly. Just going in and out of a door would literally take up half the time. Okay.
Yeah.
So then it became a question of, it took blocking and staging to a whole new level, because and that's the part I love the most about directing this film, which was just the actual physical movement of actors, camera, and me. And so it was kind of like I called it the human Tetris directing it, because it was like, you know, I would move this way, you move that way, then I'd go this way, the camera goes here. We're literally having to choreograph every single movement because there's just no room to move. And we're just dancing around each other for the whole shoot. And it was really a lot of fun. And then as soon as we said cut, boom, the doors would open, we get air pumped in there, and it would just, people can, you know, just step outside for a second. And so the directing was really the number one job was the staging and blocking had to be worked out to the very, very fine level of detail. And that was a lot of fun. And then the second thing about that is that I insisted that that every scene looked different. I didn't want to just set a camera up. Some people would say, oh, you just set some GoPros up. You know, right. and just shoot, that's it, and get the whole capture of the movie like that. I said, no, this is going to be a movie. This is going to be shot as if we had flyaway walls kind of thing, but we don't, right? So that was really important to be extremely. Everything was planned, every shot, every camera movement, every actor movement, everything. And then you look at some ways to like you're talking about your Sundance film. I mean, the more planned you are, the more you can respond to accidents, things like that, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what happened here. We didn't deviate from the script. There's very little ad-libbing going on, occasional thing here, but it was a very tightly controlled thing. The second thing is the lens, camera, and lens choice is very important in lighting.
Yeah, what'd you shoot on?
So we shot it in the Red Dragon,
small camera package.
It was all handheld. But more important than the camera was the lens, right? So in order to make the space work, it had to be on a very wide-angle lens. So the vast majority of the film was on an 18-millimeter Zeiss, a vintage Zeiss classic lens, and it was the Mark III, which is a beautiful lens. 18 millimeters gives you a massive field of view, but it has very little distortion. So it doesn't look like a, you know, crazy weird fisheye thing. It was a beautiful thing. And then we kind of stayed consistent with that. So the lens plotting was that if we're inside the booth shooting the characters, it was 18 millimeters. Anytime we switched the point of view where it's him looking out into Times Square, we would switch to an 85 millimeter. And that gives you that kind of brings the people outside closer to you. And then occasionally we would switch for a close up or two, maybe to a 35 or a 50 millimeter, very rarely. But that 18 millimeter lens, and then I wanted to shoot wide open. Okay. Meaning that a very, very shallow depth of field to give it a very cinematic, creamy feel. So the combination of using a vintage lens in 6K with shooting wide open gives you that look now, but it becomes a big challenge for the camera operator. And the focus pulling, because you have very shallow depth of field, and you know, if you're off by an inch or two, you'll lose focus. And so he was basically doing his own focus, the DP, who was also operating. And the first AC would come in and do other things for setup, but he was literally, you know, had one hand on the lens and he's racking focus as we're moving around. Constantly moving camera, you know, in this tight space. So that was a lot of, I love the technical challenge of it. And the lighting we built into the set, you know, we put Kino flows into the actual set, which is fantastic.
Now now the movie's been released and it's been sold, yeah. And it was sold to Vertical, if I'm not mistaken, right?
So Vertical Entertainment picked up the North American distribution rights. Last week they did a day and date theatrical release, 10 cities, mm-hmm. Around the country, 10 major markets, and then simultaneous release on all major VOD platforms, cable on demand. And so that's happening right now. Anyone can get the film, Amazon, iTunes, Vudu, wherever. And then we've sold the film overseas as well through a sales company. Yeah.
And you're doing well overseas. I mean, financially, the numbers are coming in. Are decent.
Numbers are coming in decent. We're still going. We still got another, you know, every few months is the next market, whether it's Cannes or
AFM. AFM
is coming up. Yeah. Yep. AFM's then Berlin after that. And so, it's going, it's great. We've sold to Germany, South Korea, other places, Middle East. I mean, all.
And it's going to, and it's going, and because of the, you know, the star of the movie in a lot of ways is Times Square.
Yeah. That's a big, you know, what the, and this is what the sales company came on board for that reason. They love the concept. It's when you're looking at, I knew going in, you have to think of what is our distribution strategy going to be? You know, what is, who's going to buy this film or will see this film? And so I was really counting on two things. Because it's a high concept genre film, thriller, that has more value overseas in foreign markets than, say, a straight comedy or a straight drama, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. So right away, that gives us some advantage. And then secondly, for casting, we cast François Arnault, who was the star of The Borgias on Showtime, and he just finished on Midnight Texas on NBC, was the star mm-hmm. of that. And he has a very loyal fan base. He has like a very, you know, amazing
passionate,
this small but very passionate fan base around the world.
I found that TV actors have a lot of times more than movie star, like movie star actors, because they're with them longer. There's more episodes. There's more connection.
Exactly. That's a really good point. Yeah. And you know, he's just an amazing guy that everybody, they love him, you know, and they swoon over him. And so I knew, you know, that was going to be our base for VOD and for digital and things like that. Cause, and he's been great. Cause he's on his Instagram to his tens of thousands of followers, and he's talking about it, and they can't wait to see it. And so that's been really, really, really good. And so, like, you know, you've talked about this so many times on your podcast about finding and building your own audience, you know, and, mm-hmm. and to tap into his audience was the kind of the key thing for us. So we'll see how that keeps going, but yeah, and so far so good.
But having the location of New York City's Times Square, internationally, I have to believe that is a selling point.
Right. It's right on the poster, you know, the big lights and the neon and exactly right. Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, it's the same thing. For my film, Sundance is Park City is the star, you know, it is one of the stars of the film, and people want to see that experience and to be there. And that was very obviously strategic on my part to be able to do that as well. So.
People who can't get there, they want to experience it through your film, right? So that's what it is.
Exactly. So now I'm going to ask you a few questions I ask all of my guests. What advice would you give a filmmaker wanting to break into the business today?
Okay. I would say it's two things. One is to do a lot. If I were starting again, you know, I would do more shorts. I would do a lot more. So I would just say keep doing a lot. But the second thing, and probably the most important, this certainly for me, this was the most important thing, is to be ambitious. And not ambitious in terms of success or money or fame, but be ambitious in your filmmaking. You know, yes, you can get some friends together and you can get a house and you can film in there and you can do a lot of great things. But I feel like every filmmaker should challenge themselves in some way to find at least one thing in the film you want to do. That's just hard, you know, it's hard, because if it's hard and you pull it off, it'll pay dividends in so many ways, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I say, be ambitious, try, do something, come up with a story, come up with an idea, come up with a location, come up with something that if you can make it work, it will be great. And don't just take the easy path. It's never easy to make films, but challenge yourself in some way creatively so when people see what you're doing, they're like, "What? You tried that?" And even if you don't totally succeed at it, it doesn't matter. Exactly. You've become a better filmmaker. You've become even stronger than you were before. So that's what I would do, definitely.
Well, like I've said this before in the past, is all filmmaking careers are forged in the failures that we have.
Yeah.
And it's the truth. Like, you know, even if you don't succeed all the way, man, you aim for the sun and you land in the moon.
Yeah.
Most people don't even walk out of their house.
No. In fact, I take it a step further, which is that you actually have to fail to see. Like, you actually.
No, you have to.
You have to.
Like, fail and fail not, often. Fail and fail often.
Exactly. You get stronger and stronger, and it's, you know, just no way around it. Definitely.
Now, can you tell me what book had the biggest impact on your life or career?
What book had the biggest impact? Is it film, filmmaking?
No, it doesn't matter. Whatever book. Either it's a filmmaking book or another book.
Okay. Okay, let's say I when I was a teenager, as a birthday gift, I got the History of Warner Brothers, which I became obsessed with Humphrey Bogart and these great, you know, 40s, you know, and I wore a fedora. I was the only kid who wore a fedora to high school. You know,
you were very popular, I'm sure.
Yeah, that's right. And I became really obsessed with the history of film, cinema history, and that was way before I went to college and film school. That had a huge impact on me. I think a little later on, Sidney Lumet's book on directing is essential. It's so essential. Yeah,
a good book.
It's so good. It's so good on so many levels. Yeah, that had a big impact on me. I read novels. My favorite novel is a novel called "Soldier of the Great War" by Mark Halperin, which is this epic, beautiful. It's about beauty and in this grand scale that had a huge impact on me.
All right.
Yeah,
that's good. Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
The hardest lesson. Ego.
Oh, my friend, you're tapping into something I talk about on a daily basis.
Oh yeah, yeah, definitely. That's the albatross. You know, when I was younger, as a teenager and into my 20s, I was like, I'm gonna be six. This is gonna happen. That's gonna happen. And I'm just waiting for the phone turn. They're gonna, you know, Spielberg's gonna call me and say, "Come on, you're the best." You know, I have nothing to show for it. You know,
inside your own mind, you were huge. You're a legend in your own mind.
Sir. Exactly. And it was soul crushing when I actually realized. What is it? I'm not even close to where I want to be. I'm not even like in the ballpark.
I can't even PA on a Spielberg set.
No, exactly.
I can't even intern.
It's like, what am I, you know, and it's kind of like, so that was a bit. And then when I went to England, going back now to the beginning, you know, the script, my mentor, his name is Bart Gavigan, an amazing guy. He just introduced to me the whole concept of service, you know, that the opposite of ego is serving, right? You have to serve other people's needs. And I thought, and he presented the idea of screenwriting and filmmaking as a service profession where you're actually serving the audience.
Yes.
You know, you're actually serving their needs, their need to have stories told, their need to learn about life, their need to have an emotional experience. It's if you see yourself as a servant, you know, humbly, that transformed my writing. It transformed how I direct. It transformed how I deal with crew and cast. And it's like I'm not the guy in charge. I'm here to serve. You know. And the more you serve, the better leader you become.
Yes.
You know? And so that took me a while to figure that out. And I'm glad I learned that lesson. Yeah.
Preach, my friend. Preach. I'm in the middle of the book "Ego Is the Enemy" by Ryan Holiday. Uh-huh.
Right.
The Obstacle Is the Way was his first one, and then Ego is the Enemy, and then now I think his Stillness Is the Way is this third one coming out soon. It's a trilogy of his books on Stoic philosophy, those books are amazing. Now, what is the biggest fear you had to overcome with making this film?
Okay, the biggest fear is that it's not going to be as good as it is in my head, right?
I mean, that's every filmmaker's fear. Yeah.
But I was more so in this case. It was more, I think, with the other film, like the first one, doing The Accountant, that was, if I failed, it was like, well, I'm learning how to do this. And it was, you know, with The Million Colors of Heaven, South Africa, it was so big, and I was at the mercy of other people, you know. And so if it didn't work, I could explain it away, you know. But in this case, rapid eye movement, but again, you just embrace it, and whatever happens, happens, you know. So, yeah.
And three of your favorite films of all time.
Number one, Lawrence of Arabia.
Okay.
By far, number one. Number two, which was a big influence on this movie, is Hitchcock's Rear Window.
Yeah.
Rear Window with the self-contained, that was the inspiration. Self-contained thriller, you know, with a lot of humor. And by the way, the Rapid Eye Movement has a ton of humor because it's as he gets into day three, day four, day five of this sleep deprivation, you just start to lose your mind and the behavior becomes more and more erratic. And he does crazy. He starts to hallucinate bizarre things. And the way he reacts to it, the way he deals it, and it's really, and that was Hitchcock. What I learned from Hitchcock is the nexus of suspense and humor, which you don't see that much of these days.
You should have more of it because it's a great combination. It's a wonderful combination.
Yeah, totally.
And it's dark. Yeah, it's like dark humor too. Yeah, like Get Out. Exactly. Yeah, Get Out.
And so Rear Window. And in fact, this is a funny memory. When I was 13, trying to make movies, I said, I'm going to mount a remake of Rear Window in my backyard. And we tried to build an entire front of a, we had just re-sided our house. We had all this old siding. I said, let's build this into a huge apartment building, like a front of an apartment. It didn't work at all.
But you learned something, I'm sure.
I learned. Yeah, exactly. And third, I would pick, I would have to pick at least one Spielberg. So, and that could change on any given day. So I'll go with Raiders of the Lost Ark right now, you know, but that could change tomorrow.
Yeah. Like I'm trying to think like, what would be my favorite Spielberg movie? Like, I think, God, man.
Yeah.
It's like, it's so like Jaws never gets.
Yeah.
Old.
Jaws. Because Raiders. Jaws. Yeah. Sometimes it's Jaws. Jaws is perfect, you know?
No, Jaws is just perfection. Yeah. That's just perfection.
I don't know if you've seen these guys that are on YouTube that do analysis of Spielberg's directing.
I'm sure I've seen it.
Oh, this is incredible. But Jaws is the – when you actually hear what he was – it's maddening because it's like he was 28 when he made this perfect – like, oh, it's like half depressing, half inspiring.
That movie. Oh, yeah. That's a whole other episode.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Now, where can people find you and where can they find Rapid Eye Movement?
Yes, that'd be great. Rapid Eye Movement is available pretty much on every VOD platform, iTunes, Amazon, Vudu,
Google.
Google Plus, or Google Play. Yeah, definitely. They can get me, peterbishai.com is my filmmaker website. They can contact me there. I would love to hear from anybody and talk
more.
Careful
what you wish for.
Bring it on.
Is that your experience?
Yeah.
I've had other guests. They said the same thing. I've had other guests put their emails on the show. Just be careful. And they call me back weeks after the podcast gets released. Like, Alex, stop. I'm like, hey, it's on you, man.
You're the one that said it's on you.
So if that's the case, knock yourself out.
I'll send them your way if it gets too much.
No. Listen, Peter, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, man. It's interesting to see, you know, I really wanted to go into how to shoot in an impossible location and how to shoot in an impossible scenario. And shooting in Times Square is pretty much the definition of that. So I really wanted to get into how you did it, but it is an inspiring story. And it does, I hope everyone listening really gets the idea of that audacity is something that is a very powerful tool in filmmakers. Like if you just would want to do something so like crazy, like shoot a movie in Times Square or shoot a movie at the Sundance Film Festival while the Sundance Film Festival is going on with nobody understanding what's going on.
Right, right.
That audacity got me my crew because they're like, I kind of want to see how that turns out.
Yeah.
And same thing. I'm sure there was a lot of people who signed up for it. They're like, I just want to see how you do this.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's a great feeling. I've had that feeling many times in my career. Almost all my projects, I try to do something that's a little bit just like, this is crazy.
Yeah. It's crazy. Crazy, but if you organize chaos is fantastic. Yeah.
So thanks again for being on the show, brother. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you so much. It's great talking to you.
I want to thank Peter for coming on the show and dropping amazing knowledge bombs on the tribe today. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode and check out his movie Rapid Eye Movement to see how he did what he did, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/381. And if you haven't already, please head over to filmmakingpodcast.com. Leave a good review for the show. It really helps us out a lot in getting this information out to as many filmmakers as possible. Thank you again for listening. I hope you're all being safe out there. I know we're going through a very stressful time in the world with the pandemic, going on, but this will pass. And please take advantage of this time to better yourselves, educate yourselves, write, do things that you would not normally have the time to do. So when the opportunities do present themselves, you'll be ready. Thank you again. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. And I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at IndieFilmHustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.